Welcome everybody. First of all, for those people who are listening on Torah in Motion, we have a bunch of people who are on Torah in Motion. On the bottom of your screen, there is a link, and that link is to the source material, which you can download. So I apologize that it took all of the lectures to get this all straight, but thanks to Mark and to Torah in Motion, we have this all set up properly. And for all of us sitting in here, the source material is in the middle of the table. Okay, this is the last of this series. The next series will begin the end of January, and I will communicate with you as soon as I get it. The JCC is just working out their schedule to figure it out, but it'll begin the end of January, and it's going to continue in the theme of prayer. What I'm going to do is, though, this semester we kind of talked about prayer generally. Next semester, I'm going to take specific prayers, but kind of prayers out of the ordinary, and try to study those prayers and kind of generalize from those prayers. So that will be next semester. Those will be five lectures beginning whenever it is at the end of January. Okay. Now, today's class is the last class is about the 20th century philosophies of prayer. Last week, what we did was we studied the Reform and Conservative movements, Siddurim, their prayer books. So, with that introduction, what I want to look at today is the following. Again, the Orthodox didn't change the Siddur. But how did the Orthodox address the challenges of the Enlightenment? How did the Orthodox address the challenges that all of a sudden people, and people in the 19th century don't just mean the non-Orthodox, it means the Orthodox as well, they became more man-centered, or they became more interested in things making sense. You know, I thought last week about, you know, that we talked about the Enlightenment, which deserves obviously an entire semester on its own. I gave it one sentence, which of course isn't fair. So I can't give it much more than one sentence today, but at least I'll give it one example today. What's maybe the most famous book written during this period? I don't know what you're going to say. I always think the most famous book written during this period is Candide, which was written by Voltaire. Why did Voltaire write Candide? What was Candide? It was a reaction, it was his reaction to the earthquake in Lisbon in 1755. And he was so upset about the fact that actually innocent people, but most specifically, that innocent women and children had been killed, that he, you know, that he questioned his whole belief in God, and he died someone who didn't believe in God. But that's an example of the Enlightenment, that it has to make sense. If it doesn't make sense, you'd say, what do we say if it doesn't make sense, if bad things happen to good people? You say, that's one of those things in religion that doesn't make sense. But in the Enlightenment, that wasn't good enough. If it didn't make sense, then it was no good. They wanted everything to make sense. How did Orthodoxy address this issue of the Enlightenment, of things needing to make sense? You're welcome to sit on the desk, but you're also welcome to bring a chair if you want. The chairs are, I don't know, is there a chair in the back? But there are chairs in the other room if you want. Sorry. Okay. Now, the only way to understand how the Orthodox address the question of the Enlightenment, of things making sense, is to start with the Rambam. Let's look at what I would call the classical presentation of what prayer is all about. You know, the Rambam, Maimonides, unlike the Shulchan Aruch, unlike the Code of Jewish Law, didn't just tell you the hows and the whats, also told you the why, the background. And the Rambam begins the laws of prayer, Hilchos Tefillah, with this background. I take this, this translation comes from Isidore Twersky's Maimonidean Reader. And he says like this, you see Laws of Prayer, Chapter 1. To pray daily is an affirmative duty, as it is said, and you shall serve the Lord your God. The service here referred to according to the teaching of tradition is prayer, as it is said, and to serve him with all your heart, on which the sages commented, what may be described as service of the heart? Prayer. So, there it is, right there, and it says number of prayers is not prescribed, no form of prayer is prescribed in the Torah, nor does the Torah prescribe a fixed time for prayer, hence women and slaves are under an obligation to pray, this being a duty, the fulfillment of which is independent of set times. I'm not interested in talking about that now. What do you see from the first couple of lines here? What is the classic presentation of prayer? What is prayer? And you shall serve the Lord your God. The Rambam says that there's a biblical obligation, an obligation from the Torah to serve God, to pray. That prayer is service of God. So the classical interpretation or presentation is that prayer is serving God. Now, what's the problem to the post-Enlightenment Jew when you have a presentation that prayer is serving God? What's the problem with that? What's the problem? What's the problem? Prayer is serving God. How does that sound to everybody? Why? What's the problem? Joe's not afraid. Well, you know,
The problem is that a large part of the prayer is much more directed towards personal...
What does it have to do with me? Or to say it the way Voltaire will say it, if I have a problem today, and I daven Maariv, and tomorrow morning I wake up and my problem is not resolved, then what does it mean prayer is my service of God? That's not acceptable. So one issue is the issue of how does prayer relate to me specifically. The other is this idea that I'm serving God by praying, and I'm, in a sense, communicating with God. It doesn't work that way, right? It just doesn't work that way. And to the post-Enlightenment Jew, Orthodox Jew, this wasn't satisfactory to them. They wanted an answer. They wanted to understand prayer in terms that they could appreciate. Now, they wanted to understand prayer in terms that they could appreciate, but they weren't willing to change the prayers, right? The Reform and the Conservative movement, they had a problem, so what'd they do? They changed the prayers. What are the Orthodox going to do?
The traditional response in the Talmud is to get a collection of anecdotes where a prayer is effective.
Good. You see, that's good to the medieval Jew. The medieval Jew says, you know, prayer is not effective. Yeah, the prayer is effective. And let's look, Gemara and Tanis, they pray and it rains and everybody lives happily ever after. But they're too sophisticated in the 19th century. They thought they're too sophisticated, right? You want to say it like that, right? Let's not take away from the people living in the 12th century, right? They thought they were very sophisticated. They're academic, the Jews are in university, they're being challenged by the Wissenschaft school. They believe themselves to be intellectuals. They need an answer to that question. So the first approach that I want to look at that deals with this question is on the next page, the Hebrew source. It's actually a source written by someone by the name of Rabbi Jacob Tzvi Mecklenburg. Yaakov Tzvi Mecklenburg. Yaakov Tzvi Mecklenburg dies in 1865. He is a rabbi in Königsberg in Germany. He is a fierce opponent of the Reform movement. So therefore it means that he wants to defend Orthodoxy against the Reform movement. And he wrote a commentary on the Chumash, which is still used today, called Aksav HaKabbalah. He also wrote a commentary on the Siddur, which is less widely known, but extremely important, called Iyun Tfila. In the introduction to Iyun Tfila, his commentary on the Siddur, he's bothered by the meaning of the word Tfila. Actually, there are many who are bothered by that, by the meaning of the word. Tfila. What is the root of the word tfila? So what? No, tfila.
Palel.
What's palel mean?
Judging.
Al chet shechatanu lefanecha biflilut. What does biflilut mean? Yom Kippur, what does biflilut mean? Judging people or judging ourselves, right? That's the word. Hallel means to judge. That's what Hirsch says. Mecklenburg says something different, okay? Look what he says. Look at the underline. Ki ikar shoresh pilel shtei otiot. Hey, Lamed, Bella's already jumping up. Right, already. There's a big debate. Very, 1 minute. 1 minute, Nana Rabella. Exactly 1 minute, okay? There's a big debate among medieval Jewish grammarians about Hebrew words, the root of Hebrew words. One view is that every Hebrew word has a three-letter root. Even if it looks like it's two letters, there's an extra hey or something at the end, and therefore it's a three-letter root. There's another view that says you can have a two-letter root. This view is followed by Rabbi Mecklenburg. He says that the root of the word palel, lehit palel, is pelamet. Shebet tosefet he yore al havdalat davar mi davar. V'hifrashtem ze mi ze. And what is, so he says, the word pelamet means to separate. And that's the pasuk in Mechumash. V'hifla ben miknei Mitzrayim. What does that mean? God separated in the plagues between the flocks of the Egyptians and the flocks of the Jews. Only the Egyptians, well, you know, got the plagues and not the Jews. The word that's used is hifla, pelamet. That's the word. U'mishoresh zeh yishamshu rabotenu Lashon Pele, Pelamede. And from this root, the rabbis introduced the word tefillah, to pray. Al Hasarat Hazuhama, or Biur Hapsolet Mehabegadir. What does the word pale mean? To separate. What is the experience of prayer, says Rabbi Mecklenburg? It's the inner separation that everybody goes through between that which is good and that which is bad. Basically, the way he sees it is like this. We are all one kind of complicated combination of good and bad. Why do we daven? Because when we daven, we bring out our good, and we separate the good from the bad within ourselves. And because we separate the good from the bad within ourselves, that allows us to be what? Better people. So prayer makes us better by separating the good from the bad. Now, how is this explanation different than the Rambam? Joe, what do you think? How's it different than the Rambam?
Right.
You don't like it, but that's not a good answer. I didn't ask for your opinion. I asked how they were different. Of course, the Rambam says that prayer is about serving God. Mecklenburg dies 1865, opponent of the Reform movement. He's a person who's involved, a rabbi who's involved in, you know, in the Enlightenment and defending orthodoxy against the Enlightenment. But look what he says. He turns prayer inward to us. And he says the experience of prayer is about us. It's how we separate the good from the bad within ourselves. That's unbelievable, isn't it?
Yeah, but I mean, he doesn't have any sources in the Talmud.
Good, good. It's extremely creative. Yeah.
It comes from the word pilel.
Now, I understand. Hirsch says it comes from the word pilel, means to judge. You judge yourself, but judging still has to do with God, because you judge yourself. No, it doesn't, because it's reflective. It's hit pael, so you judge yourself. That you separate within yourself. Good. So he, but look what he does. Mecklenburg, the people we're going to look at in 1 minute when we turn the page are philosophers. They're going to give us fancy philosophical kinds of explanations. Mecklenburg is not a philosopher. Mecklenburg is a commentator on the Chumash. He's someone who wrote a commentary on the Siddur. He's not a philosopher. But he looks to the word tefillah to make davening relevant to the 19th century Orthodox Jew. Yes, so you're right. It's reflexive. So the word pei lamed means to distinguish, and in the grammatical reflexive form, it's to distinguish within yourself. And then, but now you still need to be creative. What does it mean to distinguish within yourself? That means to separate the good from the bad within yourself. It's really, yeah, you like that? I don't agree with you, Joe. I think it's brilliant. Well, good. So let me answer that for a minute.
You know what? Yeah. The general consensus.
The Rambam says it's still right, but that doesn't matter.
What's the general? In
the Rambam, most people accept the Rambam's view, but that's irrelevant to him. It doesn't matter whether it's the Reis or the Rabbanan for him. So what do you want to say? You say it's a stretch. The answer is that because the word tefillah is an unknown word, any explanation is going to be a stretch, right? Means anything is going to be creative because we don't know what the word means. It's not a biblical word. So you're going to, but I'm not concerned, Joe, that he's stretching. I'm impressed that the stretch is what I would consider to be a 19th century response to what prayer should mean to the Orthodox.
Yeah. What was the evolution of the concept of prayer in Christianity? I mean, the early Christianity had essentially, if you say, so there wasn't any actual dialogue. It was some more repetitive type of sort of analogous to the Rambam.
Christianity is more complicated because the Protestant Reformation in the 16th century really dealt with this issue earlier, because Luther already said that religion needs to be the property of each individual. Everybody needs to study the Bible themselves. Don't rely on the Pope and don't rely on the priest and all those kinds of things. So actually, you know, there's a similar phenomenon as you would imagine, but I would say the 19th century phenomenon kind of, you know, reflects in a sense what happened in the Protestant Reformation. Why it happened in different times is a historical question. So you're 100% right, but I would just time it a little differently in terms of that. Okay? So, that is Mecklenburg's explanation. I think a very, very interesting explanation. Again, addressing the problem of what does prayer mean to the 19th century post-Enlightenment Orthodox Jew who needs to see things as making sense, as relevant to themselves. He says that the experience of prayer based on the root of the word pei lamed hei, or pei lamed, means to separate within yourself, to separate the good from the bad. But if you separate if you get up every morning and you daven, you're separating the bad from the good, and you're bringing out the good, and therefore you'll be able to go through the day and be good. And just in case you lose a little bit during the day, in the afternoon you daven mincha, and in case you want to make sure that you go to sleep at night and you still separate the good from the bad, you daven marid. Now, he doesn't make those couple of jumps, but that's kind of understood that that's so.
Yeah, but I mean, do you think the words of tefillah are inherently doing that?
Well, there, Joe, that's a good homework assignment for you. And that is, you have to go through Mecklenburg's commentary on the Siddur and see whether he holds true to that. Means, does he actually give certain explanations in the Siddur based on his definition of the word tefillah? I have no idea. But it's a good question. Okay. Yeah.
Can I ask you a question of semantics? Why do you say bad instead of evil?
Oh, I have no reason to use the word. Good and evil are the more classical words, right? Yeah, good and evil. Okay. I mean, he's clearly making that distinction. I mean, whether you call it good and bad or good and evil, he's saying that people are a combination of the two, but he has this idea that it's kind of this, you know, this combination, you know, which is indistinguishable, and somehow prayer allows us to distinguish between the good and the evil. Okay? That's a fair question. Yes.
Is this related to Gan Eden, where good and evil become mixed together, and is this undoing that process, or is that just...
You know, what he says about this, I showed you. There ain't nothing else here, right? So you want to say it's my Torah. That's good. You mean the idea of separation between good and evil is an interesting question, where that comes from. That also requires some history, right? About what the history within Judaism is of this idea of separating good from evil. Yeah.
Kabbalah has some out of
it. Yeah, this is, in a sense, this German rabbi is kind of Kabbalistic. But I'm not so interested in that piece. I'm interested more in how it reflects on the person. Okay, good. This is good. Yes, Bella.
Maybe just to answer Joe, maybe the implication is that the Tfilah is all good, and that the bad is within the individual.
Okay, you know, I think Rabbi Neffenberg would be very happy that we're sitting here arguing about what he means. I think that's exactly what he would want. Now, let's move on to the next. The next person I want to look at is Abraham Joshua Heschel. Abraham Joshua Heschel was born in 1907, and he died in 1972. So, you know, last generation. He was a descendant of the Maggid of Meserich. He came from a Hasidic family. He, from 1945, taught philosophy at the Jewish Theological Seminary. So he was a very interesting mix of chassid and philosopher and teacher at JTS. We all know that he was very much involved in social activism. And, you know, among the most famous Jewish photographs, you know, in the history of American Judaism is, you know, of Heschel walking with Martin Luther King. Right. So, you know, he was involved in a lot of different things. Maybe his most famous book, you know, it's a most famous book of Heschel is his book called Man's Quest for God. It was written in 1954, okay? You know, you think about it, 1954. 1954, you know, was a long time ago. What does that mean, a long time ago? In terms of Jews' commitment to prayer, 1954 is a long time ago. Let me say it in very concrete terms. There are a lot more people davening today than were davening in 1954. Or there are a lot more people davening more frequently today than were davening in 1954. So whether or not to daven was a real issue in 1954. And this is what Heschel says. Look on page 18. I take it from the introduction here. He says like this. Now, this seems to be a fact. God is of no concern to us. But there's another startling fact. His being of no concern to us has become a profound concern. We are concerned with our lack of concern. And Joe says to me, give me a break. Okay? What does that mean? I don't know what that means yet. But what I get from those three lines is that he's addressing our problem. What's our problem, our post-enlightenment problem? He says it as explicitly as anybody could say it, which is what? God is of no concern to us anymore. Now, if God's of no concern to us anymore, what's the problem?
Why do we pray?
Now, maybe why do we observe commandments? But this book is not about commandments, it's about prayer. So he's going to say, why do we pray? So Joe, for at least for now, leave the last two lines out here, okay? God may be of no concern to man, but man is of much concern to God. The only way to discover this is the ultimate way, the way of worship. For worship is a way of living, a way of seeing the world in the light of God. To worship is to rise to a higher level of existence, to see the world from the point of view of God. In worship, we discover that the ultimate way is not to have a symbol, but to be a symbol, to stand for the divine. The ultimate way is to sanctify thoughts, to sanctify time, to consecrate words, to hallow deeds. The study of the Word of God is an example of the sanctification of thought. The seventh day is an example of the sanctification of time. Prayer is an example of the consecration of words. Observance is an example of the hallowing of deeds. There is no question that there have been courses that have spent an entire semester on that one paragraph. There's much too much in this paragraph. But what does he say here that's relevant to us? What does he say? How does he define prayer? The crisis is, right, if we had a blackboard, we would say, crisis for 20th century American Jew, 1954. What would you put on the blackboard? There's the blackboard, right? What would you put on the blackboard? You'd say, we're not interested in God. Okay, that's fair, we're not interested in God. Heschel's solution, what would you say?
Holy words.
Yeah, but you have to tell me what that means. What does it mean? He says, God is of no concern to us. So the only way that we can relate to God is if what? In a sense, we rise up to God and become like God. We sanctify ourselves. Look what he says. In worship, we discover that the ultimate way is not to have a symbol, but to be a symbol, to stand for the divine. If we say the words of prayer, we're not only saying holy words, we're making ourselves holy. By making ourselves holy, what do? We're saying that God all of a sudden is relevant to us. God is not relevant to people, but God is relevant to what? To people who are, to
holiness.
To holiness, right? God is relevant to holiness.
It's a little like mass, isn't it?
That we make, that
you do it, and then it
happens. You see, what is Heschel trying to do? Heschel is completely different than Mecklenburg. Mecklenburg said that prayer is about us, right? It's about defining within ourselves, or distinguishing between in ourselves between good and evil. Heschel doesn't say that at all. Heschel's a philosopher. Heschel says we have a crisis. God's not relevant to any of us, right? God's of no concern to us. But Heschel is a philosopher. What does he need to do? What does Heschel need to do if he's a philosopher and God's of no concern to us? What does Heschel feel that he needs to do? Make God relevant to us, right? You understand? Heschel has a whole different view. Heschel tries to make God relevant. And he says, how can you make God relevant to people to whom God is not relevant? What's the only way to do it? What's the only way to do it? Good, okay, that's right. Maybe it's a more old-fashioned word. But what does he leave it? What does he say? How do you make God relevant? By making us holy. Right? By making us holy. And that's what he says the same thing about Shabbos. How is Shabbos relevant? Because by sanctifying the day of Shabbos, what do you do to Shabbos? In a sense, what happens on Shabbos according to Heschel? The day of Shabbos and the observer of Shabbos rise up to heaven. They're elevated to heaven. So it's not as if we're still on the earth, because when you're on the earth, God's not no concern to us. But as soon as we elevate ourselves, as soon as we rise, all of a sudden God is relevant because what? Because we make ourselves God.
Yeah, but I mean, obviously this is, I think, from
completely different than the traditional view of prayer. You see, the traditional view of prayer sees people, right, the old-fashioned way you would say, sees man, what we would say today, sees people as being humble and worthless and begging God, even though we have no right to beg God at all. Heschel says, that ain't gonna work no more, right? It doesn't work that way, because as people, as humble people, we're just not interested in God anymore. And therefore, to say that we're going to pray to God out of our humility doesn't work. Therefore, how does Heschel deal with that? Exactly the opposite. He says the only way to worship, the only way to pray to God is to what? Is to not feel humble, but to feel as if prayer does what? Makes us holy. And the minute that we're holy, all of a sudden we can relate to God because in a sense we're on God's level. What do you think about that?
He's ignoring the words. Manu mechayenu aharei hara.
Now, was he claiming that this was always the purpose of prayer, or that in the modern sensibility, this is the only way?
Good. There, I have two. I have two questions, and Andy, you ask a third question, and I'll answer all three.
The comment on the time, 9 years out of.
Good.
You have to take it.
Of course, 1 second. I have 3 points, we'll answer one at a time. Okay, Bella's point is that what about the davening? Every word in the davening is about how humble we are, and forget the daily davening. What about Yom Kippur? I mean, what does he do about Yom Kippur, right? Well, maybe Yom Kippur is different because you actually rise to God in Yom Kippur. But the liturgy is filled with who are we, right? So the answer is that's the difference between a philosopher and a commentator on the Siddur. That's why I started with Mecklenburg, and then I went to Heschel. I don't know what Heschel does. I don't know enough about Heschel. You have to speak to a Heschel scholar to find out how he, you know, what he does with the words of the liturgy. That's a fair question. I don't know the answer to. But I know that he's approaching as a philosopher rather than as a commentator on the Chumash, on the Siddur. Yeah, the question was?
Does he say that this is the way?
Oh, was it new? It's just related to Andy's question. You see, what is he saying? There's no question that he's saying that this is a modern philosophy of prayer. You know, I entitled this class Modern Philosophies of Prayer because I didn't want someone to raise their hand and say, what about, you know, what about all the medieval philosophers? What about the Abarbanel and what about this one and what about that one? I wanted to look at the 20th century because I wanted to deal with this question. This is no question it's a 20th century philosophy. Now, I'll get your question in 1 second. Another thing to be said, of course. This is philosophy. To some of us, philosophy doesn't ring true. Right? To say that by praying, we elevate ourselves to God, to some of us that makes sense, and to some of us, you know, it doesn't make any sense. But you know what? I'm not so concerned about whether it makes sense to us, Joe. I'm much more interested in the methodology. I'm interested in Heschel's methodology, and this is the answer to Andy's question. Heschel's methodology is God is of no concern to us. 1954. I started by saying, because I didn't want to start with the Holocaust, but I'm going to end with the Holocaust. I started by saying that in 1954, the average American Jew is not interested in prayer. In addition, the average Jew in 1954 is just beginning to come to terms with the Holocaust. Heschel is someone who was here before the Holocaust, but someone who, you know, was European, someone who lived, you know, the experience of the Holocaust. He believes that the only way to pray, the only way to be, to worship God in your terms, is to what? Is to rise above the world. Because if you're on the world, if you're in the world post-Holocaust, 1954 in America, there's no reason to relate to God. So you see that, Joe? Again, the detail of whether you like philosophy or not is not so interesting to me. But you're 100% right, Andy. It's the only way he can deal with this question is to bring everybody up, is to bring people up through davening, is to bring Shabbos up, right? And that's his famous book, The Sabbath. He does exactly the same thing with Shabbos. He has to elevate them, because on this world, he can't see any holiness. It's a very, very interesting approach. Okay? So that's number two. We start with Mecklenburg, okay? Mecklenburg says you reflect on yourself, you separate within yourself. Heschel, who actually, interestingly, asks the question much more directly than Mecklenburg, saying in 1954, God is of no concern to us. And he gives a philosophical answer, but a very interesting kind of philosophical answer. Number three, Rabbi Soloveitchik.
Rabbi Soloveitchik.
Rabbi Soloveitchik talks about prayer. There's some note here that we're going to be off in a few minutes. Rabbi Soloveitchik wrote a number of works about prayer. There's a volume that came out. You know, they're now publishing Rabbi Soloveitchik's volumes. What do they call it? Torah Harav? There's some organization that's publishing the Rav's books. One of the first volumes that came out, was called Worship of the Heart, which is a collection of essays of the Rav on prayer. And it's an interesting essay. But I want to go back, since, Andy, we were talking about kind of taking it historically, I want to go back to maybe the Rav's most famous English essay ever written. And that essay is called The Lonely Man of Faith.